first episode of Season 2 of Five or Flop, a podcast for the best and worst historical fiction has to offer. I'm your host, Erin.
And I'm Grace. And each week, we'll be reading a different historical fiction book to see if they're a five or a flop.
So after our brief little season break, we're back and better than ever with Season 2. Our theme for Season 2 is book talk and bestsellers. And Grace, can you tell us what that means?
That means we are going to be reading books that have topped the charts, that have made it big, whether it be on the New York Times bestseller list, whether it be in the popular consciousness 20 years ago, or whether it's on Book Talk last week.
Yeah, so these are some more popular reads than last season were, and a lot of us were recommended to us by friends and Book Talk as well. Another special surprise we got coming this season, we have even more special guests.
Yes, if you enjoyed some of our bonus episodes with one or two of our friends, you'll have even more of that to come this season.
Yes, so no spoilers on that. Not this episode, future episodes.
Yes. Erin, I am really excited for this season because in season one, neither of us had read any of the books before, except you had read A Land Remembered like 15 years ago.
Of course.
But this season, I've read a lot of these books before.
I have as well. And you as a listener can go onto our Storygraph Challenge and see the full list ahead of time. We won't get ahead of ourselves here. But I have also read a couple books, and I will say already, some of my rankings have changed from when I read them the first time.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll have to do some old versus new comparisons, yes. And some of them will be new to you, but old to me, vice versa. Mm-hmm. It'll be a great season.
Yes, we're really excited for this one. But before we get started, what's up with you this week?
Well, Erin, you have just finished moving.
God, and yes,
now
finally.
It is my turn.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
Yes, so I am, you know, shopping for couches, blah, blah, blah.
And Grace is actually moving in with data scientist Ashley.
Yes, the roommates with the mostest. So you guys can look forward to having more guitar riffs and math on the podcast in the future because we will have extended access to data scientist Ashley.
We're actually going to set up the pod studio in Ashley's bedroom. So she's just going to sleep in the hallway.
Ashley, I hope you're ready for that.
Well, that's exciting. I know I'm helping you move at the end of the month.
Yes, because I helped you move. So yes. Now...
That was the problem. See, Santiago and I said, we're like, okay, any of our friends who help us move will help you move. And... unfortunately, all of you showed up and showed out.
Yes.
So now we have to help all of you. We helped my old roommate, Kat, last weekend, and then several more weekends of moving to go.
Yes. We have a lot of it booked. You are not going to be my biggest fan because Ashley is moving very little furniture, and I am moving a lot of furniture.
That's okay because I also moved a lot of furniture. One bit of fun Kat and I had moving out of our apartment was actually data scientist Ashley helped us mount a TV when we first moved in, except... her handyman skills failed her because she broke off a screw in the wall. So it's just been bulging out of the wall. And we're like, oh, shit, we're losing our entire security deposit. And then I get a text from Kat today. And her parents are there. And she had told them, oh, don't worry about it. It's whatever. And she's like, next thing I know, they handed me the screw. It's out of the wall.
Oh, my gosh. Kat's parents, biggest slay in the world.
Honestly, Santiago and I were so impressed because we tried real hard. We actually just tried to hammer it into the wall. That didn't work either.
Oh, maybe you shouldn't have done that.
So what have I been up to this week and also the entire season break? Binge watching Desperate Housewives.
A classic.
The greatest show of all time. It's actually, and I've read many quotes by the actors, specifically Eva Longoria, who has said this show could never be made today because it would not be received well.
That is extremely true.
It's like, don't get me wrong, it's the greatest show I've ever seen. It's horrible in so many ways. However, now that Santiago and I live together and we both work from home, we have it playing in the background. We are whipping through this show.
And let me tell you, just so you all know, listeners, the context is that after several months, Santiago and Erin have recently finished watching all 8 seasons of Dance Moms.
After several months, Grace, after a year and a half. It took us a year and a half to watch all of Dance Moms.
So if your question is, what do I do after I finish Dance Moms? The answer is watch Desperate Housewives.
It's kind of like a more extreme version.
No, literally.
In a way, with less kids. So Santiago's favorite part of Dance Moms was the mom drama.
Of course.
Mine was the dancing. So this is like a bit of a compromise. I will say we've begun to identify all of our friends as different housewives. I would say you are probably Lynette because you're a girl boss, but not that you have a bunch of kids, but you have a bunch of roommates. And sometimes
I'm wrangling.
Sometimes you wrangle all of them And you got a little haggard.
Lynette gets shit done. I hope that was not you coded calling me ugly.
No, oh, hardly. I love Lynette. She's such a girl boss. Santiago is Brie because he's a clean freak, so it makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Brie is Santiago if he was a card-carrying member of the NRA, which he's not.
You know, that is true.
And I would say I'm Susan. Susan is arguably the worst, but she uses her daughter as a therapist, and I use my dog as a therapist.
Oh. So Flynn. Who's Flynn?
Oh, my God. Flynn. I feel like Flynn is
Eva Longoria.
Okay, Flynn could be Eva Longoria. She could be Edie Britt. Flynn, I think, also has to be Lynette's terrible children who are just monsters.
That's not untrue.
And one last thing about Brie, my icon. She is truly the leader of the gay son or thought daughter movement because she has both. And I love them. I love her kids.
Okay. Well, if anyone wants more analysis of a 15-year-old TV show, you know, just check back in next week. I'm sure Erin will be still watching
Desperate Housewives. Oh, I will have more.
Okay. Aside from what you watched over the season break, what was the best thing you read over the season break?
I have two, and we have two returning queens of the podcast, Maggie O'Farrell and Lisa C.
Woo!
Most recently, Maggie O'Farrell, I read just before we came into record, actually. The book was called The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, and it was way different than Hamnet. It is not historical fiction.
Yes, it was one of those ones where when I was Googling her backlist, like a ton of stuff popped up, and I was like, I had no idea she wrote all of this stuff.
Yeah, I loved it. It kind of plays with perspective in an interesting way. Okay. I really liked it.
Okay.
And then by Lisa C, I actually listened to the audiobook of The Island of Sea Women.
Okay.
C spelled S-E-A and not S-E-E like Lisa C. And then I learned after I finished it, that book was incredible. It was very similar to Snowflower in the major themes.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah. But I think had I read Island of the Sea Women first, I would have preferred it.
Okay.
I gave them both 5 stars. But I think it's like, if I read it first, I would have preferred it.
Okay. They're both high quality and like kind of comparable in quality.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then I learned, so my work has a book club that you think I would be a part of, but am not a part of. They actually read that last year for Women's History Month. Yeah, I was doing a deep dive searching for stuff to post on our company social media, and I saw that. I was like, holy shit, okay.
We love Lisa C. Lisa C is Women's History.
Yeah, agreed.
Lisa C and Maggie O'Farrell.
Agreed.
And us.
They're Podcast History Month. Okay, Grace, what about you?
I have been reading a little bit more nonfiction. I tend to read a lot of it, but I kind of was slow to get into it at the beginning of this year. Mm-hmm. But I read after seeing the movie Killers of the Flower Moon, which I really enjoyed. And it lent additional context to the movie, actually.
Okay.
It's not very long. So if you're willing to sit through that movie, which is more than 3 hours, I think you should read the book, which is less than 300 pages.
Oh, that's a fair trade-off.
Absolutely. It gives you a lot of context. I have mentioned this already, which is like an extremely unimportant detail, but so weird to me that I cannot stop thinking about it. Every character, there are pictures in the book of like the real life people.
Ooh, fabulous.
Yeah, because the story takes place in the 1920s. You know, it's not so long ago mm-hmm. that there were no cameras or something like that. But every single character who was in the movie and the book, they were ugly in the movie and hot in real life.
That is so unfortunate.
It's so backwards, and I don't know why they chose to do that.
I would be pissed. When someone eventually makes a movie of my life, I'll be pissed.
I better be hot.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. No, it would be like in the movie.
I want the actress who plays Brie to play me because we both have red hair.
That would be amazing. No, like in the movie, it would be like a guy with like, you know, 2 teeth and like really old and like blind in one eye. And you're mm-hmm. like, okay, I guess that's what like a moonshine runner in Oklahoma in 1920 would look like. I don't know. I wasn't there. And then in the book, you like turn the page and it's just like a very beautiful, like John Wayne looking man.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
They did him dirty.
All of them. Like probably 5 times this happened. But otherwise, you know, the research of the book is impeccable.
Mm-hmm.
You get a better perspective from the book than the movie because the perspective in the movie is from the white people who are the evil murderers.
Okay.
And the book, I think, places more of an emphasis on the Osage. So I would really recommend reading the book.
Okay. Good to know. I think it's been on my list and I just haven't pursued it. I haven't really been in a nonfiction kick lately.
Listen, I got a Book of the Month membership for my birthday sometime when I was in high school several years ago. And it was a Book of the Month option then.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't pick it. And ever since, I literally have been like,
wait,
I should have gotten that book.
You can pick which book you get?
Yeah, Book of the Month. They offer you, there are 5 book choices and you pick one.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. No, they don't just send you a book. You get to pick.
This is like when I had one of those beauty box subscriptions to BoxyCharm back during the early days of COVID.
I never did BoxyCharm, but I did Ipsy and I have done Birchbox.
I love BoxyCharm because you get the full-size product. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I liked it. But I like getting to pick things. But some of that was a surprise. But anyways, what are you currently reading?
I literally just started a book, I would say, less than an hour before we started recording.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I started the new Stacey Willingham thriller. It's called Only If You're Lucky. She has published two thrillers before this, and I thought both of them were really great. Mm-hmm. And that's coming from someone who doesn't read thrillers a ton.
I was going to say, that's not usually what you pick up.
No, it's one of those, I feel like I'm one of those people who, you know, you see a lot of book talkers who read these like big, thick mm-hmm. fantasy books, and they'll read a bunch of them in a row, and they're like, I want to read a little romance as a palate cleanser, and then I'll get back to my big, thick fantasy books.
That's you, except romance.
I'm kind of the inverse. I like read my happy books, and then in between, I'm like, why don't I read a little thriller as a treat? So this is my treat thriller. What about you?
Well, like I did over the break, I'm kind of back in an audiobook kick. So what I do is, because we live in DC and I don't have a car, I walk many places. So I listen to audiobooks whenever I walk somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading by another pod favorite author, Isabel Allende. I'm Woo! Listening to A Long Petal of the Sea. So this takes place during like the Spanish Civil War. And I'm just getting to the point where some of the survivors of the war, some of the exiles are migrating to Chile.
Okay.
So
I'm
excited. I
have purchased Isabel Allende's newest book. Okay. I forget, it's set in World War II. I honestly forget the details already of what it's about. It's called The Wind Knows My Name.
Okay.
I haven't read it yet, but I'm very excited to, because you know I loved Violetta.
Yeah, I know that. I like this one a lot, too. It's very different, but I like it a lot. It's a lot more focused on a lot of characters. Like, Violetta was just Violetta.
Central, yeah.
And then I'm reading one called 40 Rooms by Olga Grushin.
When I saw this on your story graph, it intrigued me a lot.
I simply got it off a library shelf. I was just wandering and it looked interesting.
Listen, that is one of my marks of like a true reader. Like, and not to gatekeep because I hate when people do that, mm-hmm. but I just love the experience and I feel a kinship with people who just like walk into a library and pick up a book they've never seen before and discover stuff that way.
Oh, that's
so
my favorite.
Fun.
This is something I really like. It's so each chapter is, it's literally 40 rooms. Each one is set in a different physical room
of
your life.
Oh my gosh, 40 chapters?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, okay.
So I think I'm at like chapter 31. I think I have like 100 pages left or something.
Okay.
And basically it goes through the rooms of her life. She starts as a child. She's an unnamed narrator. She starts as a child and then progresses up. So each one is kind of like a snippet into her life and it tells a full story.
Wow.
There's also a little bit of magical realism that I'm not the biggest fan of in this book, but I love the concept and her writing is like stunning.
Okay.
Beautifully written.
Okay. So anyone listening, 40 Rooms.
I would recommend.
Okay. There we go.
And something I'm just realizing, we never told our audience what book we're talking about this week.
Have we been leaving you in suspense this
whole
time?
Sorry to build the tension on you.
Erin, drop the bomb.
Maybe not the right thing to say about this book.
Erin, tell everyone.
This week we are reading All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. And this is a very, very well-known book, so we thought it was a great bestseller to start out the season with.
Yes, we're starting off with a bang, and just at the end of last year, this book is pretty old, but the mini-series just came out.
Yes.
Starring my beloved Mark Ruffalo.
That's another thing that's really fun about this season, is there's a lot more show and movie adaptations than there was last year. Last year, we just had Snowflower and The Luminaries, which we couldn't watch The Luminaries because it cost too much money.
Yes, but actually, I did a quick count. So last year, season one, we did 12 books. This season, we're doing 15 books. And of the 15, I think 7 of them either have a movie or a TV show.
Holy shit.
Yes.
So wow.
We are going to be going crazy with the bonus episodes this year,
yeah,
I think.
We are going to be going crazy. We're also going to... All the Light We Cannot See, I actually watched while I was home over Christmas and had COVID.
Did you like it? Not having COVID, the show.
I did like it. There were a lot, and we don't have to get into this now by any means, but there were a lot of changes that, like, I don't know. I think it made it work better for a show.
Okay.
But anyways, let's get into the synopsis, which I will happily read out loud right now. Marie Laura lives with her father in Paris near the Museum of Natural History, where he works as the master of its thousands of locks. When she is 6, Marie-Laure goes blind, and her father builds a perfect miniature of their neighborhood so she can memorize it by touch and navigate her way home. When she is 12, the Nazis occupy Paris, and father and daughter flee to the walled citadel of Saint-Malo, where Marie-Laure's reclusive great-uncle lives in a tall house by the sea. With them, they carry what might be the museum's most valuable and dangerous jewel. In a mining town in Germany, the orphan Werner grows up with his younger sister. Enchanted by a crude radio they find, Werner becomes an expert at building and fixing these crucial new instruments. A talent that wins him a place at a brutal academy for Hitler youth, then a special assignment to track the resistance. More and more aware of the human cost of his intelligence, Werner travels to the heart of the war and finally into St. Malo, where his story and Marie Laure's converged.
Long, just like the
long
book.
Long summary, long book is about a little over 500 pages.
Yeah. After the Luminaries, this didn't honestly seem
it
long
didn't
to
feel
me,
that long.
But it is long.
The Luminaries broke our spirit of long books. Anyways, let's talk a bit about the author.
Okay.
So first fact, he was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio. And I only know this because that really surprised me. I definitely figured he was European.
Really?
Yeah, I don't, his name doesn't really like give super European, but I think just because of the setting of this book, I'm like, it just felt authentic to me.
Okay. Well, congratulations to Mr. Anthony of Cleveland.
So this book won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. As we did note, it was made into a Netflix miniseries very recently. The author writes a lot of short stories and essays, and he also has 3 novels in total.
So including this one?
Including this one.
Okay. Well, I am familiar not with his other books. I haven't read any of them, and I had not read All the Light We Could Not See before this. However, I know that one of his books is about Grace. So, you know, I'm a fan of that.
Okay, well, we do love that. We love some Grace representation here on the pod.
I hope it's good representation.
I read this book back in high school. So it came out in 2014. I probably read it like 2016. So okay. Pretty soon after.
Like still within the peak of its popularity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it kind of had a resurgence of peaking popularity, I think, like right when it came out and then the build up around the Netflix show.
From what I recall, when this book came, like this book had a lot of staying power.
Yes.
Like it stayed popular for a very long time.
It's on this season for a reason.
Yes. It was not just one of those books that I think a lot of times Pulitzer winners don't necessarily have that crossover appeal. Like they hit with a niche audience, mm-hmm. but this had very broad appeal. I think a lot of people, like everyone was reading this book.
If someone's going to pick up a historical fiction, just like a casual reader, not someone who's into historical fiction like us, it's probably going to be a World War II historical fiction.
Yes, we had to try to not just pack this season with World War II.
I think we, at first, when we just did it based off, like, book talk, like, I know we had the Nightingale on here, we had a bunch, and we got up to, like, half the books, and then we're like, okay, we're limiting this. So we, I believe, only have 2 this season.
Yes, and I think if we had, like, written all of our options on slips of paper and picked 15 out of a hat, we could easily have,
it could have been
10 World War II. Yeah.
Yeah. World War II is very popular. But I think this book in particular stands above even the rest in that subcategory of popularity.
Yes. And I enjoy the slant of this, which is that it's about a niche event that not a lot of people have heard of. Like, it's not about Normandy or Battle of the Bulge or, like, anything like that. It's about the Siege of St. Malo, which I had never heard of.
Mm-hmm. And we will get into a bit more into the history and stuff as we go. Before we begin our discussion, we want to give our typical disclaimer, same as season 1, that our judgments come based on the book and characters within the book, rather than any real historical figures they may have been based on. I don't believe these characters were based on anyone specific, but in some of the books we do read, that does apply. And also spoilers, so if you want to read the book first, we suggest coming back to this episode later.
Yes, and you have had, you know, 10 years, so if you
wanted to read this book,
I hope that you had, or at least seen the show.
You might be on a waiting list for a bit still at the library, but that's okay. All right. We have different thoughts.
I was going to say, first off, let's break the ice. It's the same as the Luminaries. We're picking up where we left off. We read a really long book, and one of us likes it, and one of us doesn't.
I love this book. I loved it in high school. I remember sitting in the dark babysitting when I was finishing it and crying. I think I cried when I read it this time. I love it.
And I don't hate this book, but
it's
that's... kind of all I can say. Yeah, I think this book is such, I have never read a book to me that is more neutral. Like,
okay.
I just didn't really feel anything reading it. When I wasn't reading it, I wasn't thinking about it, which to me a lot of the times is a hallmark of a good book, or at least like a book that makes you feel something, even if it makes you feel negatively. It was just so 3 for me.
Okay.
I don't think it's a flop necessarily, but it's a low fine.
Okay, wow. Interesting. And I do not think that is popular opinion either, besides just my opinion being popular. But I think one of the most interesting things to note about this book, and probably a good place to start a discussion, It has a very interesting structure. So as we can tell from the synopsis, Marie, Laura, and Werner, that's two storylines. There's also a third storyline going on with this Nazi jewel expert. I don't even remember his name, honestly. This Nazi jewel expert. And he is trying to hunt down the jewel that Marie, Laura, and her father have taken from the museum to St. Malo. This is called the Sea of Flames. It's supposed to be like whoever possesses it has immortal life. So this Nazi officer is trying to hunt it down. And these three storylines don't converge at all until they meet in San Melo at the end of the book. However, throughout the book, throughout their journey, there are flashes forward to that final siege of St. Melo.
Yes. And this all of that stuff you just said kind of contains my thing that I like the most and my biggest problem.
Okay.
So that's a bunch of good jumping off points for us
there.
Okay,
great.
So first, let's talk about what I liked. I think it really worked that the chapters alternate Werner and Marie Laure.
Yes.
I really liked how it went back and forth. I didn't ever think that I was like, oh, we should have had an extra Marie Laure here. Or
no.
Like, the back and forth really did work for me.
The pacing was one of the strongest, like, writing elements of this.
I agree with that. I think the pacing was really good, and as a longer book, it needs to propel you forward.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the job of the writing to do that, and it definitely did in this case. Every so often, it would jump backward and forward in time a little bit. So you have the main plot line, which, like it says, it starts when Marie Laure is a very young child and Werner is a very young child. It progresses towards the war and towards eventually when they will merge at the Siege of St. Malo. But every so often, you will also get a flash forward to the Siege of St. Malo. Those confuse me a little bit, but frankly, I think that's a me problem. Because Anthony Doerr does say, like, have the dates on the pages.
Yeah.
But I think that every other really did work for me. The flashes from the Nazi character, whose name was Von Rumpel. I looked it up while you were talking.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to call him the Nazi officer. But
I thought it worked where he was placed.
Mm-hmm.
His POV was, like, very much on the back burner.
More limited.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did not like his purpose in the story. The thing about the story that I liked the least was the diamond.
Okay.
Let's get into it. So Marie Laure's father works at the Natural History Museum in Paris. They have this amazingly rare gem. It's like giant and beautiful and whatever. And it's rumored that if you have it, you will live forever, but people around you will die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a trade-off thing. First of all, I don't like that this World War II story is kind of revolving around this, like, kind of silly thing.
Okay, that's fair.
You know, the father is really fixated on it whenever you get into his head. And I'm like, protect your blind daughter. It's World War
II. Yeah, the father
was
he was the only character I had issues with.
I enjoyed the father from Marie Laure's perspective. I did not enjoy the father from his own perspective.
Yeah, that's fair.
But then you find out after having been in his POV for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
So Von Rumpel, the Nazi officer, is trying to hunt down this diamond.
He also has a terminal illness.
That was
my
problem.
Which is why he wants the diamond.
At first, I was just like, oh, he's been ordered by the Reich to hunt down this valuable diamond and take it from the French.
Which was a thing that happened.
Yeah. So I was like, yeah, that seems like a thing they would do. But it turns out he wants the diamond because he's dying and he believes the story. And I just think that is dumb.
Okay. I see your point, and I actually had in my notes that I can understand why people didn't like the gem aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a little, like, it felt a little cheap at times.
Mm-hmm.
But I think overall, I liked it as a kind of a physical symbol of what was happening. Not just to tie them together,
okay.
But a symbol of...
Will France fall into Nazi?
Yeah, France? It's like, will... And just even just looking at Marie Laure, it's... One person who's surviving, everyone around her is dying.
Mm.
Like, she loses her father, her aunt, her mother's not there to begin with, like, and all of France is falling, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I do like how it kind of represented that, and how, because it starts off from a child's perspective, and I think even through the end, she's only, like, maybe 16.
Yes.
It kind of... A story like that would make something like the war more understandable to a child living in it.
Okay, you're right.
In that sense. So I think it acts, how I read it acts as a symbol for, like, if we were living in World War II and we had young children, like, how would you explain that, what was happening?
Mm-hmm. You're right. That's a good way to view it, as, like, a microcosm of the war. I think I kind of cynically, like in my not enjoying the book that much, yeah. I viewed it kind of as more of like a MacGuffin.
Yeah.
Like just fair. A way to bring Marie Laure and Werner together, mm-hmm. which doesn't happen until what I think is too late in the book, considering how long it is. But then I think that the tone was not strong enough. I don't think okay. Anthony Doerr picked a lane enough. I think this book either should have been a gritty and realistic depiction of World War II, which at times it is. Like, you have a scene at the end of Werner leaves behind his sister in a German orphanage, mm-hmm. and she and all of the other women and girls are assaulted by Russian soldiers.
Yeah.
Like, that's the most graphic depiction of the war you get in the whole novel. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, you have this kind of legendary, like, kind of magical dreamlike
symbolism, yeah.
gem hunt that's not, like, it's not this gritty realism. And I think had he picked one or the other, it would have landed better for me.
Okay.
But to me, it came across as a bit confused.
So
like,
almost,
his tone was not aligned.
I want to say it's almost similar to The Drunken Tree and Fruit of the Drunken Tree of, like, we never, it was a confused symbolism.
Yes.
Okay.
I would say that.
Okay. I understand where you're coming from. Like I said, I can definitely see how people didn't like it, but for me, it worked.
Mm-hmm. And I think it works for most people. I think there are people it doesn't work for. My mom didn't like it at all.
My mom, I can't remember if my mom read the book, but we watched the show together. She enjoyed the show. So.
Well,
she,
good.
She read the book years ago, so she didn't remember much of it during the show.
Fair. Like we said, it was popular 10 years ago.
Yeah, popular. So I think she probably read it originally when I did. Before we move on, because I do think we should talk about the characters and their plots kind of separately.
Yes.
Because, again, they don't converge till later. One more thing about the time jumps, which is funny because I'm jumping back in time to when we talked about hated that. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
Usually time jumps for me in books do not work. I am pretty anti-time jumps in books.
Okay.
Actually, we're going to hit a book later in the early half of this season where I have a massive issue with the time jump.
Okay.
It worked for me really well here. I thought it amplified the pacing and kept building up that tension for the eventual siege.
Yes.
And as a reader, like you said, it's kind of like a niche instant in World War II. Like, I didn't know about the siege before this book. So it kind of gave a glimpse at where we were headed, which I think helped directionally with that niche.
Yes. The reason that people do this in books is to build tension. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what's coming, and then you're back with the characters who don't know what's coming. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you know, don't go to St. Malo. Like, they're going to bomb it.
And then it's like, oh, shit.
Yeah. But I think in this case, that tension, that was done really well. It was not frittered away.
Who do you want to start with? Marie Laure, Werner, or the Nazi officer?
Let's start with Marie Laure. I feel like she's the heart of it.
She's
title.
The main character, yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, so this little blind girl living with her father in Paris, and then just kind of a quick overview of what happens. They have to flee Paris. He takes the gem with them. They go to St. Malo to live with her, they call him her eccentric uncle, Etienne, and her aunt, her uncle's sister. Her aunt is involved in resistance movement stuff in St. Malo.
And I really like that.
I like that too, and we'll put a pin in that and come back to that in a second.
Great.
Her uncle is more hesitant. He's also, like, weirdly into radios because it turned out her grandfather had a radio broadcast show, which,
that
again,
will be important
that
later.
Will be important. Don't forget about that. And then eventually her uncle and her get involved with the resistance. Her father has to go back to Paris and is arrested and dies in... Is he in a concentration camp or in a prison? He dies in Nazi custody.
Yes.
And so Marie Laure and Etienne get more involved with the resistance. And that brings us to the siege, basically.
Yes. And I want to stress, their resistance activity is not huge in scale.
No.
The women kind of have an organized small protest of, like, breaking curfews and not selling food to Nazi officers, mm-hmm.
the
and,
most,
like, you know, things like that.
Probably the most, like, visible resistance activity they do, and not even visible, that's the wrong word, but the most active resistance they do is using radios to broadcast coordinates of where the Nazis' troops are planning on being in St. Malo.
Yes, that is the thing that they do that brings them to the attention of our other character, Werner.
Yes. So, before we jump over to him, what were your thoughts on Marie Laure, family, characters over there?
I think Marie Laure was fine. I don't think she did that much. I have noted here, like, this is a book that's over 500 pages, and in the first 275-ish, I don't think a lot happens, especially mm-hmm. not to Marie Laure.
Yeah, a lot happened to her.
Yes, exactly. Which is, I don't have a problem with that necessarily because that's World War II and she was a teenager. She's not, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. fighting. But it didn't intrigue me.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really give you a ton of information about her personality. I don't think she was that filled out as a character. She liked to read. She was very dedicated to her father and her uncle. I thought the relationship between her and her uncle was very touching because they had very few other family members. Mm-hmm. And they had very few other family members who understood them, but they understood each other in a way that no one else did, mm-hmm. which I like to read about. But other than that, not much there, I don't think.
No, I kind of agree with you on that. It, like I said, a lot happened to her. I don't think that was necessarily bad because I enjoyed her learning about what was happening as a child and also a blind child. So yes. It's like that is very important because her father creates like these miniature towns so she can find her way around.
Yes, that was very sweet.
Yeah,
I like the way that her blindness was worked into the story. Like, it didn't feel very heavy-handed. It didn't feel like she has to be blind for my plot elements to work.
No, it didn't.
It didn't feel like...
It didn't
like,
read that way at all.
No, it just felt like this is a person and this is what's up with her. So I thought that was nice. I think that it doesn't necessarily... A character does not have to be, like, so bold and brash and loud. If you enjoy reading about them, you do. But I think just because the rest of the book didn't come together for me, neither Marie-Laure nor Werner left that much of an impression on me.
I loved reading from her perspective and seeing how she grew up and kind of learned to understand the world around her and like the ongoing trauma of the war and learned to take on a role in the resistance. Like she might not have had the, not the loudest, but she might not have had the most like in your face personality,
mm-hmm.
but I liked her subtle development. She felt incredibly realistic to me.
Yes. And then at the end, when she is alone and she is choosing to commit these acts of bravery, mm-hmm. you believe it. It doesn't feel contrived.
It feels very authentic.
Yes, it's earned. It's not like, you know, a superhero movie where the girlfriend suddenly takes, you know, part in the battle at the end and you're like, when did you learn to do that?
No, it was very realistic.
Yes. So the buildup was earned. Like we said, the book is super well paced.
Mm-hmm.
I will not deny that.
Okay, let's head over to Werner in Germany.
Poor Werner had a terrible life.
Werner is my favorite character in this whole book.
Poor Werner. Like,
so him and his sister. Oh, so Werner and his sister, Jutta, grow up in an orphanage in Germany. They find a radio and start, like, fucking around with it. And Werner figures out he's very good with radios. And then he fixes a Nazi officer's radio and gets recruited for Nazi school.
And Nazi school.
Well, that's what it is. It's school
Hitler
for...
Hitler Youth.
Hitler Youth. There's an actual name for it, and we'll get to that in the history section, but that's farther down in my notes, and I don't have it in front of me. Anyway, so he goes to the Hitler Youth Academy, not because I never got the sense that he was, like, indoctrinated.
No.
I never got the sense that he was, like, pro-Nazi, pro-war. He just did it. Like, there was no other option. It was that or he was going to work in a coal mine and die.
Yeah. Or, like... whatever backlash would happen to him by speaking up and being, like, vocally anti-Third Reich.
Yeah.
Like, it just was not an option for him. However, I did like how you got to see, especially in the parts when he was at the school, I'll let you go back to the summary in a second, you could see how the indoctrination worked.
Yeah.
There was a lot of showing that. And he never gets fully indoctrinated, but there are parts where you can tell he's trying to talk himself into the idea that what he's doing isn't that bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's effectively showing you, like, this is what it's like to be, or what it would have been like to grow up in Nazi Germany.
And
I thought that was effective.
Even before he goes to the school, they show it in very subtle ways. Like, they hint at the propaganda. Like, they go and see a play and, like... the villains in the play are all described as, like, very stereotypically Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that building, and it becomes more and more intense as he gets surrounded. Something that stood out to me a lot when he was in the school itself was his friend Frederick.
Yes.
So Frederick was, like, his bunkmate, and he was, like, the dorky, weaker guy who, like, would stand up against the ideals subtly, but he wouldn't participate in like hurting someone else, that kind of thing.
There's a scene where they bring in a Jewish person essentially, and all of the boys say like, go up and pour ice cold water over his head, and it's freezing out and we're gonna leave him here all night. Mm-hmm. And Frederick is the only one that refuses to do it.
Yes. And so obviously Frederick is targeted by the officers and his classmates. He's like the slower one, and they have this game where they like beat up the slowest one if they, like, catch up to him, that sort of thing.
It's very horrible.
And it gets to the point where some of the boys beat him up so badly, he develops very severe brain damage. And that kind of is, like, when Werner's, like, moral quandary starts to peak. Because Frederick was his friend, but he was afraid for himself. He didn't do anything to help Frederick.
Yes. And there's even a part where Frederick says, like, you cannot do anything to help me. Like, don't. It'll make it worse for you. I understand. But Werner, of course, still has this quandary because he knows that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, so that's him kind of trying to reconcile the part he's playing by almost being a bystander. And not, maybe he's not physically doing stuff, but he's still a part. He's still contributing to the Nazi war effort. But he's also, I feel like he knows it's wrong. He's torn.
And that feeling only increases. He gets put on special assignment when they find out he's good at fixing radios, finding radio signals, mm-hmm. things of that nature. He gets put on a little crew that travels around Europe tracking radio signals of resistance. And whenever his little group finds whoever is broadcasting, they kill them.
Yeah.
Essentially. It's very awful. And at a certain point, Werner makes a mistake, and it's a group of innocent women that get killed mm-hmm. by these Nazis. And he knows that it's his fault.
And this is kind of where, although his sister is not physically on the page in a lot of the book, she's a very big presence because they are very close. And when he goes away to school, she's basically like, don't let yourself become one of them.
She was my favorite character.
She was great.
She never wanted him to go to school. She spoke up. She was loud and angry at him. She wrote him tons of letters, and he didn't really write her back. He did a little, but not.
They were also
like
majorly censored too.
Yes. And then at the end, we get a brief period at the end where the war is over. It's a flash forward, maybe 20 years or mm-hmm. so. And we get a scene of Yuta as an adult and I dealing with that trauma, but living in a safe and new world with her own family.
I had this part marked. And it's funny because I see you have a notes. You have a thought about the ending, and I think we're talking about two different endings because I'm talking about the flash forward ending that
I'm
really
not
love.
Talking about the flash forward.
Okay. Well, let's start with the flash forward for now. I love that ending. I love how you can see that Yuta and Marie Laure and also another German soldier who was close with Werner, how they're living in contemporary times. It was like the 70s, I believe, going on with their normal lives, but then the past still comes back to haunt them. Like, they still are confronted with this when Yuta and Marie Laure kind of reconvene. And they had, like, she found out that Marie Laure had known Werner. They come together. And it shows that, for me, it's kind of another symbol of, like, everything around you still contains the past.
Yeah, we don't think about that much, I don't think. We don't think about, like, learning history, reading, watching movies, documentaries, whatever. We don't think when we're watching something about, like, the 60s, like, oh, World War II was 20 years ago. Like, that is the world that Jewish people were still living in, mm-hmm. that Germans were still living in, that there's no way that all of those intense beliefs that led to the Holocaust happening, or even just, like, all of the memories that French people had of the occupation, that's not going away, even though it's in the past, theoretically, but the past is present.
Yeah, and that was something, because we get Yuta's point of view, and she's in France, and she's like, this is like 20 years in the future. She's like, do they blame me for...
Do they know that I'm German?
Yeah, like, do they blame me for the occupation, blah, 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 all
yes,
of this.
Yes,
even though I was a child, you know?
I did enjoy that part of the ending.
That part of the ending was really strong. I liked how those two women converged at the end.
Yes. Well, I think to talk about the rest of it, and to get into why they converged at the end, we need to talk about what happens when Von Rumpel, Marie Laure, and Werner all converge in St. Malo.
So throughout Marie Laure's section, Von Rumpel is, you know, there's little bits of him like hunting for the gem. And eventually he pins it down that her father and her have it in St. Malo. So he goes there.
At that point, the father's already gone. He's been taken off to a Nazi concentration camp or prison work camp, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't think he makes it there.
No.
But then during the siege, it's like the last time anyone is in the city, essentially. Yes. And Von Rumpel knows the diamond is in the house, and he spends days in the house completely tearing it apart, looking for the diamond.
And where's the diamond? It's in the miniature town the father built. It all comes back.
And Marie Laure is hiding in the attic, and she has these two cans of food that she got from the basement and no water, and that's it.
And she has a radio set that belongs to her grandfather.
The only one he managed to save when the Nazis came around and took everyone's radios.
Her uncle managed to save it. The radio belonged to her grandfather, who, as we mentioned before and forgot to talk about during the Werner section entirely, had a radio show that Werner and Yuta listened to as a child.
Yes, so that was the connection. Werner hears Marie Laure and her uncle's radio broadcast.
And he recognizes the radio, like, signal, the wavelength.
Recognizes the voice and decides not to turn them in because it was the show that he and his sister listened to in the orphanage.
And then he hunts it down because he realizes she's asking for, like, help.
Yes, because she broadcasts classical music and pleas for help.
Yes, and also reads part of a book for that's part of the resistance code. But anyways, so what's happening and why she needs help is that the Americans are going to bomb St. Malo. Like, it's the siege. The siege is coming. They know. And the city is surrounded by these big, tall gates that the Germans locked. So the citizens can't leave.
Boo.
Yeah. Really, really shitty there. So she's stuck inside. She's calling for help, not just because of this, but also because of the Nazi in her house. So eventually what happens is bombing, bombing, bombing. Werner tracks down the signal, helps save her.
And he's seen her on the street, and he's basically like, oh, like,
she's so pretty.
Beautiful girl. Yeah. That part is not really fleshed out, but it's present.
Yeah, there's like a little bit of a lovey-dovey bit. But yeah, so this happens, and then the Nazi eventually dies.
Werner shoots him.
Yeah, Werner shoots him.
Please
Werner
don't gloss over that.
He has the stone on him, right, or something?
Marie Laure has it in her little attic hidey hole, which is why the Nazi can't find it. But he's like, I know it's here, so I won't leave until I find it.
It got a little confusing, but it's okay. But anyway, so then that happens, sieging, bombing, 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 and then Werner and the other Germans surrender. And then Werner is, like, taken to this camp, and then he goes into a field and steps on a grenade.
Okay, I hated that, and it was also confusing to me. Like, I hated it emotionally, and I hated it as a story
it
construction
didn't,
moment.
That felt like, I was conflicted on that, because in part, it felt like it didn't fit with him, but then in other part, it felt like it really fit with his character of him not, I felt like under the surface of the writing, Werner knew he was never going to be able to reconcile his moral quandaries.
I don't even really know what happened to him, because after the war is over, he is in like a German camp for soldiers, and he is very sick. He has like this horrible fever and hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks out of his tent in, you know, this fever state, and that's when he steps on a landmine. And so at first I'm like, did Werner commit suicide, or was it an accident? I honestly don't know what's being implied here. At first I thought that it was purposeful on Werner's part, but the stuff that I have read online since seems to me like people think it wasn't purposeful.
Have you seen the show?
No.
Well, I'm going to spoil the show. Doesn't do that in the show. The last time we see him, he's with the other Germans, like, waving a white flag. They don't kill him off in the
show. Did they do the flash forward?
I don't believe so. That's what disappointed me about the show being different.
You wanted Werner to die?
No, I wanted the flash forward. I wanted them to get married and be in love.
Yeah, so basically in the future, the other lore of the diamond that we did not tell you is that the diamond belonged to, like, an angry river goddess, and she's like, I will remove the curse from the diamond if you give it back to me.
But no one wants to dump it in the sea because it's super valuable.
Because it's worth millions of dollars. But it's worth millions of francs. But Marie Laure gives it to Werner at the end of the story and says, please throw this in the ocean for me. And he keeps it. And
it's in the little house from the miniature.
Yes. So years later, Yuta comes back, meets Marie Laure. Werner is dead. And she says, like, this was given to me by one of his company members. It had your name on it. Like, do you know what this is?
And it was the part of the miniature with the stone in it.
Werner, you crazy son of a gun.
And it makes a way back to her. And it's that symbol of the stone is just like, for me, this is why it worked. Because it's that symbol of like, you can be fine. You're living your life and everything's going to still come back to haunt you.
Mm-hmm. And because I was reading it being kind of a bitch instead of reading into like the symbolism or whatever.
Reading the luminaries, though.
I was like, she told you to throw it in the ocean. Why didn't you do what she said?
Well, to be fair, he didn't really have a chance to.
Well, it was a town on the ocean.
But then she throws it in the ocean.
So it's finally, the curse is over. It's the end of Titanic. It's the...
Not the end of
Titanic. She drops the necklace in the water.
Remember when we watched Titanic a few months ago?
I love Titanic.
It was so good. I kept wanting the... I knew how it was going to end, and I didn't want that.
Womp womp.
But... anyways, I thought it was very conclusive, full circle. The Nazi got what was coming to him, got killed.
Yeah, it was crazy that Werner shot him.
Good for Werner.
He was not a violent man.
He was not a violent boy. He was like 16. They lied about his age to get him on the special assignment. He was like 16.
Yeah, I think he started when he was 16. By the time they meet, I think Werner is 18 and Marie-Laure is 16.
Yeah, so but like still, same thing. Boy.
Yeah. But he's like, listen, I'll do what I have to. So, yeah, I still have no idea really what the motivation was for Werner at the end there. I did not enjoy it.
I feel like it could have been either intentional or not.
I guess it's supposed to be ambiguous. I don't know. I guess I don't care whether it is or not.
Okay. I mean, yeah,
I'd like to know.
Up to interpretation. It's like in the Luminaries, why could Anna suddenly read? We'll never know. I don't even think I talked about that during that episode. I think I forgot and then was so mad at myself for forgetting.
Well, listen, it's a new season, so we're not going back there.
Okay, but you know what? Where we are going?
To the history
section. All right. I actually did a, not quite a Grace level of research on this, but an above Aaron level of research on this.
You have several sub-bullet points here on our notes.
And I'm actually going to start with a quote from the author himself that he told Netflix about the show, but obviously also applies to the book.
Okay.
It was really important to me to try and make sure every little detail of San Malo was right, Doerr told Netflix, so that someone who lived through that siege would be persuaded that the verisimilitude of this project was real.
Okay.
So his goal was to make this feel as real as possible.
Okay.
So the actual battle itself took place in 1944 between August 4th and September 2nd. Because there was a big resistance present in Brittany, which was pretty close, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazis did lock the gates to prevent citizens from escaping. The resistance did use radios to transmit coded messages, which was a primary tool to spread information for them.
Mm-hmm.
Also propaganda during the war as well, as we see through Werner's perspectives. So the role of the radio in this book was not an exaggeration. The characters itself were not real. Neither was the Sea of Flames. However, it was inspired by another cursed diamond.
Okay. To clarify, the Sea of Flames is the nickname for the diamond.
Yes, it is. The Delhi Purple Sapphire, also known as the Gem of Sorrow, which brought bad luck, and its last owner recommended throwing it into the sea to get rid of it, which is where that comes from.
That is crazy that happened at all. Like, I would have pointed to that part of the book and loudly said, that is all made up. Like, I know that there are, like, we have the Hope Diamond, which is supposedly cursed, mm-hmm. but this was so specific and, like, so not related, seemingly, to the rest of the story that I was like, oh, he just, like, threw that in to be, like I said before, like, kind of a MacGuffin or mm-hmm. to be a symbol, you know, either way. But that is crazy that the Gem of Sorrow really exists.
Yes, it is. And I like that. I'm not sure if, because I believe that the Delhi Purple Sapphire is currently in, like, one of the museums in Britain. I'm not sure if it actually played a role. I didn't look that far into it. If it played a role in World War II or not, if that was...
I would assume not,
but the Nazis... Not to the extent of the Sea of Flames in this, but the Nazis were after a lot of artwork and valuable gemstones. So it could have.
Okay. All right.
The last thing is the, as I call them, the Nazi schools. National Political Institutes of Education. Those were very real Hitler Youth Academies. Incredibly hard entrance exams, like with Werner. You had to be, quote, racially pure to get in. And that was kind of like the West Point of Nazis.
That is very sad.
Which is a terrible way to put it, but you know what I mean.
That, other than that scene that I mentioned of what was happening to Yuta at the after the war's conclusion with the Russian soldiers. That, I think, was the grittiest part of the book, even more so than the bombing itself, because that was kind of, you know, you were seeing it from the perspective of one person at a time, and neither of them were the orchestrators of that bombing.
No, and neither of them were, I mean, they were the victims, but they weren't the ones injured.
They weren't being they targeted. Weren't injured. They were fallout.
Yeah, they were fine. But seeing Frederick and Yuta, like, individually attacked.
Yes.
It was hard.
And even just seeing the atmosphere of that school, seeing that indoctrination. And we said Werner never becomes fully indoctrinated, but you can see the way that it kind of creeps up on him because there's no other environment for him to be in.
No, it's like if you're in an echo chamber, like.
Yeah, you see the effects of the boys that are fully indoctrinated. You see how boys are, you know, shamed for wearing glasses. You see how the stronger are thriving. Mm-hmm. You see the men who's are at the top of the governmental food chain get their sons into this school.
Yeah.
You see the plan to set up Nazi Germany for the next generation. And that, I think, is the scariest and grittiest part.
And one last thing to actually, I have two more things to touch about. One last about the historical accuracy as a whole. What's really great to me about the historical accuracy of this book is that in the genre of World War II historical fiction, there's many stories telling the same story, which is about, you know, people in concentration camps, people living in Germany in occupied cities, which this is as well, but it's so focused on this specific battle that doesn't often get showcased. That is why the historical accuracy is so great to me, because it really teaches me something new about a time period that I already know a lot about.
I agree. I don't think anyone who reads even a little would not agree that World War II is an extremely saturated topic in terms of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And again, not that it shouldn't be, but it is nice to see this new perspective on
it. It's hard. And I guess in terms of our star calculator in the originality category, it's hard to have a story within a saturated field that feels so different and tells a unique story.
Yes. I'm going to connect this to another book, actually, that we're not going to read for this season, but I know a lot of people have seen and liked, and there is a movie of, which is the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Have you read that book?
Not read that, nor have I heard of it.
Okay, well, it's about the island of Guernsey, which is in the English Channel, I believe, and it is the only part of Britain that was Nazi occupied.
Oh.
So it was this little teeny island, like not that many people lived on it, and it was took place after the war was over and they were recovering from Nazi occupation.
Okay.
So again, it's the same thing of like, I know a lot about World War II. I have read a lot of books about World War II. And this is a little story that I had never heard of that I appreciated being told.
Yes.
And it was made into a movie with Lily James.
Oh, okay. Awesome.
So there you go.
And I didn't include this in my notes, so a bit of a surprise for you, Grace. But not historical accuracy. Accuracy between the show and the book, because I read the book and watched the show like immediately after. There's a lot of similarities overall, broad stories, very similar. They cut out the whole part about Frederick. They don't show any of the, they cut out a lot of the gritty bits. Like they don't show anything with Yuta at the end.
I'm glad they don't do that.
Yeah, I'm glad too. But it's moves a lot quicker because it's only 4 episodes, so they tone down a lot of stuff. You don't get as much details going in, and they focus.
4 episodes?
Yes.
That is crazy.
I was watching it, and we were halfway through the 4th episode, and my mom had already seen the show. She was just rewatching it with me, and I was like, is there another one? And she's like, no, this is the last episode. I was like, what the fuck?
I hate this era of TV.
Me
too. Please
give
me, like,
give me back Desperate Housewives 23 episodes a season.
Or, like, I feel like this book was 530 pages. It can have 6 episodes.
You at least need 5 episodes, one for every 100 pages. But they trimmed a lot, and they focus a lot more on Von Rumpel. He felt like a very heavy presence.
That's weird.
And yeah, like I said, Werner didn't die at the end.
Good for Werner.
I believe her uncle was like was more present in the show as well.
I think that's
and
a good decision.
And he was the one who had the radio show that Werner listened to.
The uncle was the most, I think, vivid character in this whole thing. Maybe other than Werner.
And
I liked the uncle.
Dr. House played the uncle.
That's good casting.
It was, I was like, I had never seen this house, but like everyone remembers the Fox commercials. And I was like, I've seen this man before.
House,
It was good. It was good. They had the actress was like actually a blind actress, so they good casting, representative casting. I liked the show. I would have liked it more had I not read the book so closely.
Yeah.
In the space of time.
Yeah. Like maybe if you had read it when your mom read it, when you read it the first time and then not again.
Had I not reread it, I think I would have liked the show more because I wouldn't have, I didn't remember Ferner died. And he didn't in the show and she tosses the stone into the water like immediately.
Oh, so it doesn't go the, well, they didn't do the
They don't have
forward.
The flash forward. Yeah, no.
Justice for Yuta.
So it's very different. So in the show universe, I like to believe they both had happy endings.
Well, good. But, I hope so too.
Okay.
Time to calculate?
Time to calculate. So we're back with our same trusty old star calculator by data scientist Ashley, where we rank on a scale of historical accuracy, vibes, prose, originality, and characters.
Okay. Why don't I go first?
Okay.
So I am going to stick to my annoying thing that I do and give it a 4 for historical accuracy.
Oh my God. Grace cannot be pleased.
I feel like in this case, I didn't get a huge sense of what it was like to be there just because so much of the action in the end was confined to the house. So that's my only, like, all of it seems correct.
Yeah.
But I didn't, like, I learned that this happened, but not as much about it as I would have hoped.
Okay.
So I still think it was great in that aspect, especially hearing from you, but I'm only giving it a 4 because I only give 5s to exemplary work. I'm like one of those professors that's like, no one gets an A in my class.
That's like when I took, so I took AP Art History, but my teacher also taught like regular art classes. And she's like, I never give anyone 100% because there's always subjectivity in art. And I'm like,
thank God
I'm not an artist.
Well, thank God she's not on our podcast. vibes, 2, because this book was long and I didn't think it was my favorite. So, you know. Prose, 3. Like I said, it was good. It was serviceable. I thought at the beginning it took me a little to get into the swing of the prose. But as we were going, it was fine.
That probably also has to do with like some of the pacing and time jumps too. Like,
yes. I thought it was very well paced and it moved you forward briskly. But I think because just the way that the prose was in the third person style, I thought it kept you a little bit emotionally distant from the characters, which I didn't enjoy. Originality, 4. No problems there. This is a great choice of subject matter. I enjoy the idea of Marie-Laure as a protagonist. But characters, I will say 2, because none of them are really indelible to me.
Okay.
I liked the uncle, but I will say his name was Etienne. And I was rereading my notes in preparation for this, and I had written down, oh, I love Etienne. And I was like, wait, who's that? So, like, even that, it didn't stick
with me. To be fair, I forgot her name was Marie-Laure because in my notes, I just kept writing ML to abbreviate.
So you just think her name is ML?
Yeah. And then I was like, read the summary, and I'm like, oh.
So the characters are just they're nothing special to me. Okay. They're a little bit nothing to me. So
Verna is everything to me.
So that gives me a total of 3.
Which is exactly what you said.
Which is what I rated it on StoryGraph. To me, this book is just like the epitome of 3.
So you're a fine.
I'm a fine.
So for me, historical accuracy, a 5, because I am way more lenient than Grace is. Vibes was also a 5 for me. I just really enjoy it. I also like rereading books that I know I liked when I was younger, too.
I love to reread.
That added to the vibes for me as well. Prose, I really like it. 5 for me. Originality, like I said, tying into historical accuracy, going in a field that is very saturated and finding something so original to write about that occurred and having it still be so accurate, automatic 5 for me. Characters, I gave it a 4. I really liked everyone. Didn't really like the Nazi officer. Not even just like, I can like a character.
Like, obviously we don't like him.
I can like a character who's evil. I just didn't enjoy his character.
Yeah. He wasn't there that much, though. So there is that.
Yeah. Except in the TV show where he was there all the time.
Which is crazy. I don't know why they would do that.
So that gets me to a 4.8, which I round to a 5. So for me, this book is a 5. So I'm starting the season on a strong note.
So yeah, this is, we're mirroring the end of last season. It is a disagreement.
Probably not the most severe disagreement we've had.
No.
I think for Luminaries, I just held so much hatred because of my Benadryl-induced flight where the book kept undownloading. So That's fine.
But now we're going to leave it in the past and move on to the future. And speaking of the future, Erin, what's next week's book?
Next week we're reading, and this might be, some of you might be a little mad we're calling this historical fiction, Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller.
Yes. Any of you who were, I think, big on Tumblr back in the day, this is going to be your episode.
Any of you bisexuals that didn't know it at the time as a child who was really into Greek mythology, this is for you. And no spoilers, but we do have an extra special guest with us.
Yes, so you will have to tune in next week to hear from us and from our expert about Song of Achilles.
But in the meantime, you can make sure to follow us on social media. Our Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok are all at fiverflop_pod. We also have launched our Season 2 Storygraph Reading Challenge, so make sure you're reading along with us.
And since the last time we made a reading challenge, Storygraph has updated so that you can have challenges of specific books.
Oh, so much better.
So we are making use of that feature.
So this is a big upgrade for us. We still have our recommendation form in our bio, but if you have anything specific to talk to us about, if you are Anthony Doerr, I don't know. We have not said his name the whole time. Anthony, if you want to come on the pod, make sure to email us at fiverflop podcast@gmail.com.
And in the meantime,
happy reading.
Happy reading.